It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps.
This colossal debt.
The highest in Europe. Austerity measures.
The economy on a knife edge.
Imagine you're the finance minister of a small country. It's 2015, and your nation is bankrupt. The most powerful finance minister in Europe is forcing you into a deal that you know will ruin your country.
Government has had an international financial bailout.
What do you do?
I asked for a favor. I said, can we, for 10 minutes, pretend we're not finance ministers? Please stop telling me what to do. Because I want to ask for your advice, which is a very different thing from you telling me what to do.
That's the real former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis.
I showed him the piece of paper he was trying to force down my throat. I said, would you sign the bailout if you were me? He took a long break. I looked outside his Berlin office window. He turned back towards me. He said, as a patriot, I wouldn't. And this was a very startling thing to hear from the German finance minister. So I said to him, so why are you doing this to me? Why are you trying to impose upon me something you wouldn't have signed in my position? He said, well, don't you realize? I've imposed these policies on a number of countries. The French must understand that they would not get away with using my currency. We ended up two dejected finance ministers in office agreeing that the bailout that was being imposed upon us was not in the interest of Germany, not in the interest of Greece. Both of us knew that we shouldn't be doing that, but neither of us had the authority or the power to change that. The only one who had the power to do something about it was me, the weak link. Because I could say no.
What would you have done? Yanis Varoufakis did say no. But the choice he faced has a lot to say about who really runs the world, about the deep establishment that controls global politics and international finance, and about the moral bankruptcy of the entire system. Varoufakis was a newcomer to the scene. He was a young Marxist economist, unexpectedly picked to be his country's finance minister, right at the height of the Greek debt crisis. He told Steve Paulson it was like getting a crash course in the way power really works, from people like Larry Summers, the former Clinton advisor and chief economist at the World Bank.
In that friendly conversation, he said, in politics, there are two kinds of politicians, outsiders who feel free to speak their mind and get ejected from the political system, and therefore they make no difference in the end, and insiders who bite their tongue and stay within the inside. But the golden rule that they must abide by is that they never turn against other insiders, and primarily they never tell the outsiders what's happening inside. So which of the two are you?
I mean, basically he was saying you can either have power or you can be a truth teller, but you cannot do both.
That's correct, except that the reality begged to differ.
So you do not accept that dichotomy then?
No, I don't, because in the end, it is a tale of people who everybody considers to be extremely powerful and yet who remain utterly powerless in their official positions.
Okay, so you had a taste of power. You were the finance minister of Greece.
I had a taste of office, not the same thing. Let's not confuse the two. I had a taste of what it means to be in these rooms behind closed doors with people that do occupy extremely powerful offices. But I was utterly powerless. I was the finance minister of a bankrupt state, and I was struggling to negotiate the escape of our people from debtor's prison.
Just to set the stage here, I mean, finance minister of Greece for a half a year during this incredibly tumultuous year of the Greek debt crisis, all the eyes of the world were on you. And you were in those meetings with all the major players in Europe, the leaders of Germany, France, the European Union, the IMF. Did you like being in those meetings?
No, I wouldn't use the verb to like. It was extremely interesting and I don't regret it. But anybody that likes being under such pressure, especially under circumstances that were detrimental to your own people, is a fanatic and should have his head examined. But look, there was one power that I had. The reason why there was all this furor around me was that I had one power, and one important power, to say no to another loan agreement. You have to realize that the powers that be, the most powerful creditors in the world, American, European, and so on, they were demanding of me, because I was the finance minister, I was the only one who could sign that loan agreement, to take on another wad of money from them.
So that's interesting. So legally, actually, you were the one who had to sign the agreement, not actually your prime minister.
Indeed. That is why I was such a figure of hatred amongst the oligarchy in Greece and amongst the deep establishment in Europe. Because I was saying no. I was saying, no, I'm not going to take your money until our existing debt is restructured and made viable. And they were not used to this. They were not used to having the finance minister of a small bankrupt European nation saying no to loads of money. Of course, that money would never go to my people. It would go to them from one pocket of the creditors to another, extending the bankruptcy of the Greek state while pretending that we were solvent.
Okay, so you said no. You refused to sign that bailout package, and you lost. And your prime minister of your party buckled under the pressure, forced you to resign, and he accepted the terms of that bailout package.
That is correct. Look, we were elected together with a mandate to say no. The only reason why I accepted the position of the finance minister of Greece in early 2015 was because we had this, what I consider to be a cast iron agreement between us, my prime minister and myself, Alexis Tsipras and myself, that we would never, ever sign that deal. Because it was absolutely essential to end the spiral of doom, which began with the bankruptcy of the Greek state in 2010, then a huge bailout loan, which was given to Greece, but not to Greece. It was given to the Greek finance ministry to pass it on to the German and French banks that had gone bankrupt. It was a bailout of the French and German banks disguised as solidarity with the people of Greece. That loan was given to the people of Greece under conditions of swingeing austerity, austerity that you've never seen in peacetime in the history of the world, which, of course, shrunk the incomes from which the old and the new debts would have to be repaid. And we were elected to say no to this. And halfway in this struggle, my prime minister, unfortunately, decided to succumb and to surrender. And he asked me to stay on with him so that we could surrender together, and I refused and I resigned.
Hmm. If he had said no, as you had said no, I mean, presumably the consequences would have been profound. Your country, Greece, probably would have defaulted on its loan, and maybe you would have been kicked out of the Eurozone.
Well, they were profound anyway. My view, allow me to say, is that if we stood our ground and refused to sign on that dotted line, yes, there is a probability that we'd been thrown out of the Eurozone. But my view is that it would be a very low probability that in the end, the creditors, especially the European Central Bank and the German government, would relent. And they would relent for a very, very simple reason. It would have cost them 1 trillion euros, more than $1.3 trillion.
Because all those creditors would have been out their money of all those loans that they gave.
That's right. So, you know, we squandered a fantastic opportunity to get our people out of debt bondage.
Hmm. So who really has power? Is it the heads of government, the presidents, prime ministers, finance ministers, or is it the power brokers of the corporate world, CEOs, bankers, hedge fund managers?
There's no doubt that the CEOs of the financialized capitalist sector, the banking sector, they do wield incredible amount of power. We saw this in the United States in 2008, how they forced politicians to bail them out. Similarly in Europe, I had to deal with what I consider to be the political establishment, which gives the impression that it's no one's fault. Everybody will give you a very reasonable explanation of why they don't have an alternative to what it is that they're doing. So in the end, to answer your question, who has the power? I think that it's a system that has the power, a system which runs our lives. So we've created a monster that uses the word democracy only as a poor excuse for the fact that we have precisely the opposite.
Wow, that is a dark view of the way the world works.
But at the same time, it's a very positive view.
Wait, that's a positive view? That sounds like a horrible view.
Well, let me say why it is. Because once you start realizing what's going on, then it's really quite straightforward to do something about it. People have to realize that in the end, the greatest power lies with each one of us, citizenry. because it's only our complicity in allowing the system to reproduce itself that allows it to reproduce itself.
Hmm. How would you describe your politics? Are you a socialist, a Marxist?
I consider myself to be an erratic, inconsistent Marxist.
Is socialism viable in the world today?
Well, imagine that we were having this discussion in 1810, and the question was, is it possible to have a society without slavery? I think that most people would answer probably that it is not, that slavery has always been with us and therefore must be an inescapable aspect of human society. And yet there were some recalcitrants back then who thought, no, we will create an anti-slavery movement because it is possible to have a world without slavery. Now, the question about socialism, of course, is heavily weighed down by the awful experience of the 20th century in the Soviet Union, in so-called socialist countries, which were appalling places. So we left-wingers have a great sense of guilt, or should have a great sense of guilt. But the thing that keeps me declaring myself as a left-winger and a socialist is that, look, capitalism was not overturned by the left. We of the left failed dismally to overthrow it. But it is doing a fantastic job at overthrowing itself. Capitalism is creating the means of production, the technologies, the machines that make capitalism obsolete and therefore create crisis within capitalism. Very, very soon, artificial intelligence, 3D printers, the internet and so on and so forth will have rendered corporate structures obsolete. And the question is, what follows that?
Mm-hmm.
What's post-capitalism going to be like? I mean, capitalism is going to end. Like every mode of production, feudalism ended, capitalism will end. The question is, what comes after this?
So if you're right, if capitalism is going to end, which is such a radical statement, give me one or two scenarios of what might take the place of capitalism.
Well, allow me to give you, just for the benefit of brevity, two extreme scenarios. And
okay. Of course,
there are many different gradations in between. One is a Star Trek world in which, you know, replicators in walls produce everything we want and we can sit around and have philosophical discussions and explore the universe. Do what the ancient Athenian philosophers did, you know, discuss the meaning of life while mechanical
slaves
work for us.
While lying on our rubber rafts eating strawberries.
Yeah. Won't that be great?
So that's one possibility. Yes.
That's one extremity, the good society. And the other extremity is that we'll end up somewhere in between The Matrix and Blade Runner, a world in which technology has overtaken humanity and humanity has been enslaved by technology and everybody is worse off, including the 0.001% that own everything.
How would the masses take over control of all this technology? I mean, I'm trying to imagine a scenario where that could happen.
Well, let me give you a simple example. Imagine that we have a common wealth fund, an equity depository, if you want, that's publicly owned. And every time there is an IPO or a raising of more capital by a firm, 10% of the shares go into this depository. And this is owned by everyone. And there is a universal basic dividend that comes out of it that is paid to every citizen. Why? Because capital is these days is being produced socially. Every time you search something into your Google search engine, you add to the capital of Google. So the private ownership of capital now clashes with the fact that it is socially produced. So if we were to socialize part of the shares of every company through this kind of depository and have a universal basic dividend and increase the proportion of the shares that are commonly owned, then we have a trust fund for the masses.
But for that to happen, something must happen politically. So we're back to where we started. How might that happen so that you would remove some of the power from these technology companies and so that they would actually have to put aside this pot of money for the welfare of all?
Well, we need to copy Donald Trump. Donald Trump proved that you can turn against the establishment and win. We progressives have to become ambitious like Donald Trump was in order to do the opposite of what Donald Trump is doing. The good people in the Silicon Valley understand power. So if they see a progressive movement rising up, and at the same time realize that the way we are now proceeding is going to create a slump in demand because the masses will not have the money to purchase their goodies and their apps and their mobile phones and all that, the combination of their own self-interest and the push of a progressive political movement that is winning power, that is the only scenario I can see that will deliver good developments in the future.
That's Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir called Adults in the Room. You know, listening to that, it's tempting to think this whole late capitalist, liberal, democratic thing just isn't working. Shouldn't there be another way? Coming up, the story of how one small family-owned bank took the fall for the mortgage crisis and what we can learn from it. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Remember 2008? Subprime lenders at the big American banks crashed the economy. But only one of them faced criminal charges. In 2012, New York's District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. came down hard on a small, family-owned bank run by Chinese immigrants.
As a part of the announcement of the indictment with Cyrus Vance Jr., he chained them together. And they paraded them down the hall in front of the cameras.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of the Federal Savings Bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy.
The optics were terrible, but you know what? When I asked Cyrus Vance Jr. in the film about that, and he, you know, his answer was, there was no racism involved. We have very strong relationships with the Chinese American community. And he goes on to say, we didn't treat this bank any differently than we would, you know, an Indian or South American bank, which, of course, was quite revealing.
So not Citigroup, not Wells Fargo, not J.P. Morgan. After the financial crisis, the U.S. government went after a small family-owned bank in Chinatown? Documentary filmmaker Steve James tells the story in his new film, Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Charles Monroe Kane wanted to know more.
Who is Mr. Sung?
Well, Thomas Sung is a banker in Chinatown, New York. He started out as a lawyer there, and at the ripe young age of around 50, he decided to become a banker because when he went into the banks that served him in Chinatown, he discovered that they're willing to take his money but not willing to loan him money. And so he decided that if that was true of him, as a successful lawyer in Chinatown, what must be the case for many of the residents there? So he decided to become a banker and serve his community in that way. And he started this bank, Abacus Savings and Loan, and set about to serve his community in a way that no other bank in Chinatown at that time was doing.
You know, I think we should pause here because I think that in America, or for at least for me, when I think bank, I think big.
Right.
I think white people with ties, and I think big money. Abacus, how big was it compared to, say, the other? It was in New York. How big was it compared to other New York banks?
We say in the film that it's the 2,651st largest bank in the United States. I think they actually slipped to 2,652nd.
Okay.
You know, Abacus's assets are 0.01% of Bank of America.
That's incredible. They are so small. Now, back to Mr. Sung. Not only as a lawyer did he start a bank, which I thought was interesting, he enlisted his family, a bunch of smart daughters, into this work as well, none of whom, my understanding was, have any history in finance or banking, but they also start the bank. Tell me about his daughters.
Well, yes. Really, over the objections of Mr. Sung's wife, you know, Mrs. Sung did not want her daughters to go into the banking business. They all studied law. except Heather, who is the physician in the family. You know,
the black sheep of the family.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So the other three daughters, Chanterelle, Vera, and Jill, they found their way to working for their dad at the bank after some years, of practicing law and doing other things. And I think they were just drawn to the mission of that business and wanting to be a part of that.
And how was the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, Thomas Sung, his daughters, how were they connected to what happened in 2008?
Well, they weren't connected at all, actually. This is one of the ironies of this story. Thomas Sung and Jill and Vera, you know, they recognized that what was going on with the big banks and all of those vehicles that they were engaging in, they realized that that was not sound practice and, frankly, saw it for what it was, that it was probably not legal. And so they declined to participate in any of that. They continued to do what they had always done, which is to give mortgages and loans to people in the community that they felt were capable of repaying those loans.
So how in the world do they end up in court?
They ended up in court because it really all started with a loan that went south. There was a loan officer that worked for them named Ken Yu, who they discovered had been taking bribes from potential borrowers in order to help put their loans through. And when Vera Sung discovered this and then took it to Jill, they were sort of horrified.
Jill reminded me, Jill being the president of Abacus Federal Bank and Vera being the director of the bank.
Yes.
So they find out this guy's doing illegal stuff. They immediately fire him and they contact the district attorney and make big alerts to everyone that what happened.
Well, right. Well, first thing they do is that they contact the regulators, which they're legally required to do, and report what happened. They also contacted Fannie Mae, who was a big partner in virtually all of these loans, to let them know what had happened. And then they also, which they were not required to do, they hired their own internal investigator to come in and sort of really look into the loan department and see if Ken Yu was an outlier, if there was more fraudulent activity going on. And they discovered a couple of other employees who were engaged in some fraud, not nearly on the level of Ken Yu, but they got rid of them too. Cyrus Vance Jr., the DA of New York, decided that he thought that there was enough fraudulent activity going on in the bank that this level of really very petty fraud was somehow connected to the 2008 financial crisis. And then he had this big press conference where he brought in the feds from Washington who had been all involved with the 2008 crisis and had them stand behind him like a phalanx of, you know, feds. And then he announced that he was, for the first time since 1991, he was putting a bank on trial, and it was for the fraud related to the 2008 crisis. And then that's where he sort of planted his flag that he was going to be the guy who dealt with the fraud from 2008.
Even if Abacus Bank was completely guilty and did everything, don't you find that incredible?
Yeah, it is incredible to have this small bank scapegoated that had absolutely nothing to do with 2008 crisis at all, both in deed or in impact. But even if they weren't innocent, it's really compelling and significant that this is the bank that was chosen to be the fall guy for 2008.
If there's a crime here, who's the victim? So who is the victim here? Who's the victim of this crime?
Well, that's exactly one of the profound ironies of this case, is that the alleged victim in this case is Fannie Mae, because the prosecution was alleging that Abacus was presenting these fraudulent loans and passing them on to Fannie Mae, and Fannie Mae, you know, would be the ones that would become the victims of these loans when they went south because they had fraudulent information in them. Well, one of the problems is that of the 3,000 loans that happened during the indictment period,
3,000, only 3,000. Incredible.
That Fannie Mae dealt with, 9 went south.
Okay.
9 didn't perform. Abacus has one of the lowest default rates of any banking institution in the United States. It's 1/120th the national average.
Whoa, that's incredible too.
And then a further irony is that none of the loans actually under indictment, which were about 20 loans or so that were specifically a part of the indictment and the trial, none of them went south.
Not one of them. Wow.
So Fannie Mae was the victim in this case who earned hundreds of millions of dollars off of Abacus loans over the period of time that this indictment took place. It was pretty well known that Fannie Mae officers were waiting and hoping for this case to wrap up and that they would be able to get back in business with Abacus Bank.
Because they were making money.
And because they were such reliable partners.
You know, we're talking about banking in America, and you've been really steeped in this, following this small bank around and looking at it. Like, what should a bank in America be, especially for immigrants?
Well, I think there's kind of no better example of that than the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Can't you understand what's happening here? Don't you see what's happening?
Mr. Sung is viewed in that community as something like the George Bailey of Chinatown.
Well, your money's in Joe's house, that's right next to yours, and in the Kennedy house, and Mrs. Maitland's house, and 100 others.
And we found out that both he and his wife love the movie, and that it is a movie that is something of an inspiration to him.
We can get through this thing all right. We've got to stick together, though. We've got to have faith in each other.
And so in that movie, and It's a Wonderful Life, you see that the Bailey Savings and Loan is this cornerstone in the community.
All right, now, Miss Thompson, how much do you want?
But it's your own money,
now,
George.
Don't mind about that. How much do you want?
I can get along with 20, all right.
$20.
And I'll sign the paper.
You don't have to sign anything. I know you pay when you can. That's okay.
So I think that really does speak to sort of the higher calling of banking in this country. And it's funny, because when this film came out, a number of reviewers made the point that, you know, here's a film about a bank where the bank's the good guy. Because I think we have grown accustomed to thinking of banks as these sort of pernicious, rapacious, huge institutions that only care about the bottom line.
Steve James is a documentary filmmaker. He made Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters, and he was talking with Charles Monroe Cain about his new film, Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. By the way, Abacus spent $10 million over 5 years to defend themselves, and in the end, the bank was acquitted of all charges. If you want to see the whole film, you can find a link to it on our website at ttbook.org. So when you look at the way the world's financial systems work, it seems like the theme is more power for the few. More power for big banks, multinational conglomerates, telecom giants. There has to be a better way. But where do we find it?
You know, I'm the kind of football fan where once I was in a Northwoods, Wisconsin bar with a Packers game on and had no idea what to say to anybody, so I asked one older woman, why do you like the Green Bay Packers? She, you know, looked at me like I was an idiot for a few seconds, and then she said, well, it's pretty cool that a bunch of my family members own shares in it. What she was referring to is a system dating back to the 1920s when the team needed some extra financing, and they turned to their community, the Green Bay community, to bring in some funds to develop the organization. Since then, the Packers have been a community-owned team. It's why you don't see ads in quite the same overwhelming way all over the stadium. Ticket prices are quite reasonable. It's why that team has stayed in Green Bay.
Journalist Nathan Schneider wrote the column that led to the hashtag #BuyTwitter movement. He says cooperative platforms like the Green Bay Packers are the business model of the future. So if, say, we applied the same kind of user co-op model, community co-op model, to something like Twitter, would we users come to love Twitter with the kind of devotion that folks in Wisconsin have for the Pack?
I think you would end up with a different relationship. I'll give you another example, and that's Associated Press. This is a company that was founded as a cooperative of New York news outlets in the 1840s. And in our moment today of sensationalism and polarization and fake news, nobody is doing good old, boring, straight, real news like Associated Press. And part of the reason is that it's owned by a wide range of news organizations, you know, ranging from Fox News to everybody else. And as a result, they've had to kind of hold the center that so many other organizations have had trouble holding.
Nathan, you proposed this idea of users buying Twitter about a year ago, and it was a time when Twitter's share price was looking kind of wobbly, and there were a lot of rumors and concerns that one of the big multinationals, Disney, might come in and just buy Twitter, and that still could happen. But what would all this change if Twitter becomes some kind of consumer co-op? What's going to change in my experience of it?
I think the key thing is how difficult choices are made at the company. Really, when it comes down to it, in the boardroom, these companies have to be putting their investors before everybody else.
Sure, the share price matters more than my experience using Twitter. But these things are related, though, because if they make bad decisions and I don't like using Twitter anymore, then there goes all your user base.
That's true for now, but increasingly we're seeing a monopoly power emerging where people don't have choices. You know, so many people have the experience of not really, for instance, being able to opt out of a platform like Facebook or Twitter. You know, I'm a reporter and a professor. A lot of the times I don't really have a choice, I feel, but to use these particular tools.
Well, I've wondered from time to time, if there's public radio and public TV, where's my non-commercial public social media platform? It just kind of feels like, shouldn't that be the next thing we have?
I think these are exactly the kinds of questions that we need to be asking, and it's really important. You know, if you look at your Facebook settings page, you have all sorts of options about how different Facebook users can see your content. What you don't have is a choice about how Facebook's investors get to use that content. And a lot of that data is being used for advertising, for essentially being sold to outside entities.
How much do you think the experience of actually using Twitter would change if it was user-owned?
You know, I'm a member of a credit union, for instance, right? Day to day, my experience using the credit union is probably similar to somebody's experience using Wells Fargo down the road. The upshot, though, is that Wells Fargo has these incentive structures that has been leading it to do things like falsify account creation and get people into some serious trouble with their home loans and help spur the 2008 crash. These are things that my credit union had absolutely no involvement in because it has no incentive structures that incline it to do that.
I want to ask kind of a bigger question about all of this. Do you see this as creating an alternative to capitalism? Because we were talking about how Twitter and most of these companies, they have to grow, right? That's what capitalism kind of means. In order to create profit, you have to keep growing. So if you move to these no-growth models, is it still capitalism or is it something else?
I think it really depends on what you mean by capitalism. Sometimes when you say capitalism, people think, well, free enterprise and entrepreneurship and free association in the economy and market-based pricing and these sorts of things. And cooperative models absolutely work in that way. My grandfather was the director of a hardware purchasing co-op, a national company, you know, and I think he thought of himself as a good old-fashioned capitalist, right? But there is a real big difference, too. My grandfather's bosses were not people over in Wall Street who were just trying to trade shares around to make maximum profit. They were hardware store owners and local hardware distributors who wanted to help support local businesses against the big boxes. You know, they were, in that sense, mission-driven, locally grounded companies who were deeply participating in the business. And that's a real difference, and it means a different kind of company.
Did this grow out of the Occupy movement in any way? You covered the Occupy movement almost from the beginning.
Yeah, I was. My last book was called Thank You, Anarchy, and it was kind of an inside account of Occupy Wall Street. And I was one of the first reporters to show up during the planning stages and one of the last to leave after a lot of it had kind of collapsed and people were starting to go their separate ways. And I started seeing this generation of activists moving into the cooperative sector and feeling like they had to start from scratch because there had been this generation gap. You know, in generations past, cooperative models have been essential for supporting the agricultural economy, for developing infrastructure ranging from first electricity to then telephone networks and now broadband networks in rural America. And that's why there's a $128 billion cooperative bank called CoBank down the road from me in Denver. Historically, this has been a major, major part of the U.S. economy, though it's often not appreciated as such.
But then it kind of disappeared.
Well, it didn't disappear so much as it became invisible. And I think that was kind of a product of the Cold War, where it was kind of this rhetorical moment of what side are you on? Are you a communist or are you a capitalist? And all the folks like my grandfather, a conservative farm boy, said, I'm a capitalist, right? While running a cooperative business and doing quite well at it. And I think now is the time to reclaim that. We've got a network of startups around the country and around the world that are trying to build these kinds of businesses, but we haven't seen the mechanisms to scale that up yet.
Nathan Schneider is a journalist and visiting scholar at the University of Colorado Boulder. His most recent book is Ours to Hack and to Own. Suppose you're a novelist, wondering what your next big project will be, and then one night, this happens.
I had a dream of a woman walking toward me in what I always kind of jokingly call the badass power walk. In movies or TV shows, whenever you see like the hero walking toward the camera with an explosion behind them, their hair was billowing in the wind.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
So she's walking towards me in the badass power walk. And in this case, it's not an explosion behind her, but a mountain is floating along behind her. And she's furious at me. She was furious enough that she was going to throw this mountain at me in a few minutes if I just did not figure out why she was mad. I woke up kind of in a fever to know. Why is this woman angry? Why is she so angry she's going to throw a mountain? Also, how can she throw mountains? And thus, the germination of an idea was born.
Award-winning science fiction writer N.K. Jemisin dreams the future next. I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
This is what you must remember. The ending of one story is just the beginning of another. This has happened before, after all. People die, old orders pass. New societies are born. When we say the world has ended, it's usually a lie, because the planet is just fine. But this is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. For the last time.
That's the epigraph to N.K. Jemisin's novel, The Fifth Season, the first book in her Broken Earth trilogy. That is one of the best science fiction and fantasy series of the past decade, and it's set in a futuristic world grappling with power, racism, and oppression, with a dash of magic thrown in. As Nora Jemisin told Steve Paulson, the story is rooted in the historical moment we're living in right now.
You know, as a Black woman living in a modern-day American society, of course, I've got lots of questions about validity and exploitation. Black Lives Matter and, I guess, this book were born out of the same frustration or the same anger or the same pain. I was sitting at home and kind of writing parts of this book as I was watching Ferguson unfold on Twitter. And we started to see again and again the names of people who had been extrajudicially murdered. And you start to realize also it's not so much the murders, but it's the fact that those murders then went unpunished.
So you're talking about systemic oppression here, which is one of the themes of these books.
Systemic oppression, yeah. Systemic racism. I drew inspiration from a lot of different oppressive situations. At one point, one of the protagonists has lived her life as a woman in hiding, effectively similar to a closeted queer person. So, yes, systems that are exploitative towards oppressed groups for specific reasons.
Now, you have done a lot of world building in these books. I mean, you have earthquakes and volcanoes that have devastating impacts. There's also magic. Mm-hmm. There is this oppressive social order. And I know all this is complicated, but for the uninitiated, can you give us a brief outline of the world that you've created?
Well, that's going to be fun. All right. Well, basically, it is a world unlike our own. There is a single supercontinent here called the Stillness. Looks a lot like our own world, except periodically, every 200 or 300 years, there is a seismic event powerful enough to kick off something that the locals call a fifth season. That is a seismic winter or some kind of disaster-related worldwide massive phenomenon that often comes paired with famine and the breakdown of society and so on.
So you're talking about sort of extinction-level disasters that regularly happen.
Yes. So this is a world where in some ways the apocalypse happens again and again and again. So this is a society where most of the time they're generally sort of democratic and capitalist and so on. But they have a set of rules set up which are designed so that when bad things happen, every community breaks into its own little fiefdom and becomes authoritarian and they kick out anybody they deem useless.
You also have sorcerers, which you call orogenes. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Who have tremendous powers. Tell me about them. What can they do?
Well, there's a group of people in this world who are born with the natural ability to impact seismic events with their minds.
So they can actually trigger earthquakes or volcanoes just by thinking about
stop.
Them.
Okay. Yes. It's really more by feeling. Everyone in this world has kind of a natural ability to sense earthquakes coming. You know, we've seen this in animals in our own world. It's just sort of a little bit of science fiction to extrapolate that maybe we would have the ability to do that too if the planet selected for that ability evolutionarily. But these people go beyond that. Not only can they sense earthquakes coming, they can stop them, they can start them if there are no earthquakes happening. And when they're powerful enough, when they've practiced their skill enough and gotten good enough at it, they can literally just reshape the entire face of the planet, which happens on page 2.
So you've created this really interesting blend of magic and science, which historically has a kind of an interesting history because it's not always clear where you draw the line between magic and, I guess, what we would just call physics.
Well, that's me just kind of having fun. I've been a lifelong science fiction and fantasy fan, and I've watched the endless war between science fiction fans and fantasy fans about, is it magic? Is it science? What's better? And there's a couple of quote-unquote laws in science fiction fantasydom. Clark's Law.
Arthur C. Clarke?
Yes, yes, uh-huh. Thank you. Any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from magic. And a fantasy fan's corollary of that has always been any sufficiently complexified magic is indistinguishable from science. So with these two in hand, I was like, let's just mix it up. I don't care if it's science or magic. At the end of the day, it's basically the same thing because when the science consists of technology that is obviously based on a science so far beyond the current people's ability to comprehend, they might as well treat it like giant magic rocks floating through the sky.
Well, I would love to get a sense of what these orogenes can do, these people who can actually sort of move the earth with their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a passage in your first book in the series, The Fifth Season, that gets at this. Could you read that?
I do, yes. The proto-sheikhs, even from here, are powerful enough to make her mouth taste of bitter old metal. What? Sienite starts to turn to Alabaster, and then she stops in shock, because he is on his hands and knees growling at the ground. An instant later, she feels it, a shockwave of raw orogeny rippling out and down through the pillars of the high road and into the loose schist of the ground. And before Sien even realizes what's happening, Alabaster has grabbed her in some way she's never experienced before. She feels her own connection to the earth, her own orogenic awareness, suddenly co-opted and steered by someone else, and she does not like it one bit. But when she tries to reclaim control of her power, it burns, like friction. Alabaster has chained them together somehow, using her strength to amplify his own, and there's not a damn thing she can do about it. And then they are together, diving into the earth in tandem, spiraling through the massive, boiling well of death that is the hot spot. And before Sienite can think through this, Alabaster does something else. A sharp punch. Something has been pierced somewhere. At once, the upward pressure of the magma bubble begins to ebb. He pulls them back, out of the fire and into the still shuddering earth, and she knows what to do here because these are just shakes, not Father Earth's rage incarnate. Abruptly, something changes, and his strength is at her disposal. It becomes easy, easy to smooth the ripples and seal the cracks and thicken the broken strata so that a new fault does not form. And as the hot spot settles into just another lurking menace and the danger passes, she comes back to herself to find Alabaster curled into a ball in front of her. A scorch-like pattern of frost all around them both, which is already sublimating into vapor.
So you're talking about these people, these orogenes, who have tremendous power. I mean, how they can sort of shift the earth in dramatic ways, and not everyone likes that. I mean, they're kind of scary figures to people who don't have those powers.
They are valued, provided that they are under control. The society abounds with stories of what happens when orogenes are allowed to do their own thing and have lives and have children and, you know, basically be people. And no one wants that. If they are not careful, if they are outed and people realize that they are what they are, then lynch mobs form, and they don't usually survive those.
Because they're just considered too dangerous, I mean, by the common people?
It's similar to the way that people reacted to people who had AIDS. You know, the hysterical overreaction, the assumption that just being in the same room, breathing the same air, having them nearby was somehow dangerous. And, you know, they understand in the stillness that orogeny doesn't spread, but they also understand that it's genetic, that orogenes often have children that are orogenes. And so you want to make sure you get that out of your community before.
And there's this whole system to keep them under control. I mean, basically, they're removed from their families, from their homes when they're small kids and stuck in some special place where they're basically held captive, but also sort of trained how to use their powers.
There's always been, in highly oppressive societies, there's always been a place for those who are willing to make themselves useful to the people in charge. And in this particular case, it takes the form of kind of like evil Hogwarts. But so, yes, if they're found as children, and if there's enough time before a mob forms, the people of that village can summon someone called a guardian who will come along and collect the child that has been found to have orogeny. And they'll take that kid off to a training place called the Fulcrum. They can't leave until they're fully trained and highly valuable or highly useful. And then they are let out only to do quick missions. And then they come back home quickly before people get mad that they're there.
Yeah. Now, we've been talking about the fictional world you've created, and there's a backstory to all of this, which has to do with the industry that you are part of, the genres that you write in. I mean, you've won 2 consecutive Hugo Awards, which is a remarkable achievement, and you're the first Black woman ever to win 1 Hugo, even. But
for novel.
For novel, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
not everyone in the sci-fi world has been happy with your success. I mean, there's been this conservative backlash. It's complained that the sci-fi world has gotten too political, too ideological. A lot of the criticism at you is quite overtly misogynist and racist. Mm. What do you make of all this?
What we call these days the alt-right, i.e. Nazis, appear to have practiced in certain smaller spheres of life before moving into politics. We've seen variations on this same thing happen in the comic book world and the video game world. It was called Gamergate there. In science fiction fantasy, it's the puppies. I don't know. It's a long story about the puppy name, but this is one of the battlefronts on which they've decided to operate, because they've begun to realize that you've got to control ideas. You've got to control people's ability to think about the future if you want them to reshape the present. One of the things that I often talk about as a woman of color in science fiction and fantasy is the fact that until relatively recently, you just didn't see a lot of Black people or Black women, especially, in the future.
Right.
You saw endless iterations of the future that looked a lot like middle America, full of mostly straight white guys, smattering of women, all young and nubile, and very few of basically anything else.
So we started out by talking about this whole idea of the broken earth, mm-hmm. the title of your trilogy, which raises the question of what can come after the earth is broken. What can replace it? And I don't know, I sort of have this idea that maybe a science fiction writer would be ideally suited to help us imagine a world that is not broken, that is healed. Mm. Do you have a vision of that world?
I'm still working on that. I'm still trying to cobble together that kind of vision. It did occur to me that there's a failing in me. I struggle to envision a society that is truly free of bigotry, because that's all I've ever known. And it's such a revolutionary, difficult thought that I'm going to have to try to figure out a way to see past our present into a better future, because somebody's got to do it. And there's a lot of people out there that are imagining a much worse future. And so those of us that are tasked with the job of imagining the future have some work ahead of us. But I've struggled to do it now. I don't know that I can imagine that right now.
Nora Jemison, talking with Steve Paulson. She's the science fiction and fantasy columnist for the New York Times Book Review, and she's the author of the multiple award-winning Broken Earth trilogy. That's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher, or stop by our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Until next time.